I'm not sure that there would be a lot of attention paid to this issue. It would be treated just like any other employment benefit, but the problem is huge. And that is that we failed to set aside money necessary to pay for the promises or pay for the pensions that we've promised employees. They are massively underfunded. We've accidentally made government employees the state's largest creditors, and that's not good for them, government managers, and taxpayers alike. Now, today I wanted to cover the basics of pension funding mechanics to show how this underfunding happens. I want to cover the different pension plans around the state and to cover some ways to address this pension underfunding problem. And first, as I mentioned before, pensions of government workers are required to operate on a pre-funding model. And this isn't just a regular practice, it's mandated by Article 9, Section 24 of the state constitution. According to the delegates who added this section, workers were uncomfortable with how pensions were treated at the time. They felt like they had no legal claims to what was offered and that they were gratuities that could be eliminated if governments fell into fiscal distress. So that's why delegates added language to make them contractual rights. But to ensure that governments were not tempted to cut benefits, they also added the mandate to pre-fund benefits. That is, if enough money is set aside to pay for pensions, then there is no savings by cutting pensions since they're already paid for. So I'm going to go through this simplified model of pension funding to show how it should work and where the underfunding problem comes in. So if we go to the next slide. In this example, our workforce is going to work for 4 years and earn pensions to be paid out for 3 years. The top chart shows pension contributions to the left of the line and pension payouts to the right of the line, while the bottom chart shows our pension funding levels. So to the next slide. This is our first year, and in our first year, our workers work and earn pensions to be paid out in years 5, 6, and 7, indicated on this next slide. The employer makes contributions to pay for what is earned. If we go to the next slide. These contributions go into the pension fund displayed in the bottom chart, where money is invested in order to pay for the pension payouts in years 5, 6, and 7. The money gets invested in financial securities like stock market, bonds, and private equity deals. We assume that it will grow over time, so we need to contribute fewer dollars into the pension fund than we expect to pay out in pensions because we expect money in a pension fund to grow. Now, the same goes for year 2, which is on our next slide. Workers provide another year's worth of service and earn more pensions to be paid out in years 5, 6, and 7, which is on the next slide. Their employer set aside money into the pension system to pay for those pensions, which is on our next slide. So since we're a year closer to retirement, even though employees earned the same amount of pensions as they did the year before, employer contributions increased. And that's because there's less time to pay for pension or less time for pension investments to grow before we need to make payouts. Now, and the pension fund in the bottom of this chart increases also as the fund collects both more contributions and earns more from its investments. Now, this next slide shows years 3 and 4, where again, workers earn more in pensions to be paid out in years 5, 6, and 7. Their employers put more into the pension system and the pension fund grows. Now, in year 5, our employees are retired. Employers are not contributing anymore because there's no one earning a pension. And instead, it's time to pay out the pensions that our workers earned. In this case, we've been good stewards and have saved up enough funds in pension assets, which is shown here on the next slide. Paid up enough here so that they are able to pay our pension liabilities, which is shown on our next slide. Yep. And so that by year 7, the pension trust fund is fully depleted, as are the obligations to pay pensions. We paid what was earned when it was earned, and that was sufficient to pay for all the pension promises we made without being a drag on government finances. Now, one thing I want you to take out of this exercise is that assumed growth matters a lot. If we assume high rates, we don't need to put in as much as we would if we assume low returns. And we won't recognize that there is a problem with these overly optimistic assumptions until the future. So here's the same example, but this time we assume that pension fund investments would grow and they don't. So if we want to pull up the next one. So here's what happens in this case. Our pension payouts don't change, as indicated on this next slide. We made the same pension contributions that we thought we needed, but here we're almost out of money in year six and have a deficit in year seven. Where that money would come from is up to government managers. The government has an obligation to pay these earned pensions, but doesn't have money in the pension system to pay for it. So they have to look at whatever resources that they have available to pay what they owe. And notice again that in this case, our workforce hasn't even been on the job in the past 2 years, and yet they need money from people in year seven to pay them what they've earned. So this is what happens when we use bad assumptions. Everything looks the same. We have pension payouts, we have contributions, but the pension fund dries up before it pays out what employees have earned. Now, thankfully, we try to keep pension funds from running out of money, even if we make bad assumptions. We pay actuaries good money to assess pension systems each year to see whether we're setting aside enough money. And if they identify a gap between what is owed and what has been saved, managers then create a plan to pay down the difference before the fund runs out of money. Now, they can use plans that catch up on these debts quickly, or they can defer payments over a long period of time. Now, most government pension systems in Michigan face this exact same problem. Pensions were underfunded and managers deferred paying down those debts. This compounds year after year, where pensions get further underfunded and debt payments into the system don't catch us up. And this goes on until the gap between what is saved and what is earned is large. And these debts are large, as you can see on my next slide. Responsibility for these problems is shared by state government, which sets pension policies for the school retirement system and the state employees retirement system, and among local government managers, who are free to offer whatever pension benefits they want, subject to collective bargaining, when their employees are unionized. And in total, we're talking about $50 billion in underfunded pensions. The school system, managed by state lawmakers, is the largest pension fund in the state and covers around half of all government employees here in Michigan. It saved just 60% of what it owes. It needs $32.7 billion to catch up on these unfunded liabilities. And this is not a new problem either. The system hasn't had enough money to pay the liabilities that it owes in 44 out of the past 45 years. And the 1 year where they had enough money to pay all the expected outflows was due more to an accounting gimmick than using correct assumptions and proper funding. The cost in the system has skyrocketed in the past 20 years, increasing from around 10% of payroll to around 40% of payroll. The state systems are likewise underfunded. Only the state-controlled judges' retirement system is close to full funding. And this debt carries a cost, which is shown on the next slide. Right now, we're spending $4.7 billion each year on pension contributions alone. Around 70% of contributions go to pay pension debt rather than to pre-fund benefits. Or to put it another way, we spend more filling holes in our pension system than we do filling holes in our roads. But not every government unit faces this problem. There are a lot of townships that never offered conventional pension benefits and therefore have no unfunded pension liabilities. And there are a small number of local governments who have fully funded their pension systems. So the question is, what do lawmakers do about this problem? Now, on one hand, the solution is easy to identify. Since benefits are contractual rights, and since government managers cannot cut what has always already been earned, this kind of leaves us one choice: put more money into the system. It's a math problem and it can be solved with cash. If we're $50 billion short, we just need to put in $50 billion into these systems, which is no problem, right? Putting more cash in is only part of the solution though. If we put more cash into the system, we would be fine for a single year. But as we've seen, this is a long-term problem, and governments would likely fall into the same underfunding problem in the future, which is why we've got two basic policies which will address this underfunding problem, which is on my next slide. Legislators, almost there. Just dwelling on it for a little while.
One behind.
That's all right. Legislators just need to consider how to contain the ability to underfund pensions. And this comes in two forms. We can change assumptions and debt payment plans, and we can convert to plans that limit underfunding, and we can do both. So if we've been assuming too optimistic returns, then the state should lower its discount rate. We've been assuming payroll has been growing and it hasn't, we need to change that. And perhaps more important, when gaps are discovered, the state should pay down these debts quickly. So for that school retirement plan, back in the 90s, when they were dealing with some of these gaps, they decided to pay debts down over 50 years, which is just too long. And compiled with some other payment policies, the state wasn't even paying the full interest cost of its debts. Now, we've been working on that. We've been cutting down that payment window. We have 18 years left if we stick to that schedule. Now, changing funding assumptions is often a challenge because it not only encourages managers to put more cash into retirement systems, but it increases the stated underfunding problem. If you have $30 billion of unfunded pension debt when you've been assuming 8%, you're going to have $35 billion if you assume 7%. But these kind of changes are necessary and prudent if we're going to prevent future underfunding. Now, the other option is to convert to a system where we don't pledge benefits that can be underfunded. Converting new workers to a 401k style benefits means that managers do not have to do the complex task of pre-funding benefits. Instead, they set a contribution rate and keep to it. It can be generous or it can be stingy, but it won't kick the cost of today's government onto tomorrow's taxpayers. Another option that has been tried are risk-sharing plans. That is, employees still earn conventional pension benefits, but employees hold on to some of the risks of underfunding. So say that if a retirement system gets underfunded by $50 million, employees are responsible for paying half of that. Now, some governments have started these plans, Michigan included, and it's unclear how we're going to deal with the conflicts which will arise if employee pay has to be tapped to make up for pension underfunding. Now, note that none of the reforms I'm calling for are about overly generous pensions. Those may exist, but they're not the reason why pensions are so expensive. Underfunding is. And you'll also note that when pension reform is brought up, this key issue of underfunding that I've spent all of my time on today tends to be downplayed. Instead, interested parties focus on issues like what happens to an employee's pension if they leave before they vest, whether pensions attract good candidates, or on people who are abusing pension rules to spike their own pensions. Now, these can be important issues, but they are not the imperative reason why government leaders need to look at pensions. Again, the problem is underfunding. Now, some people believe that conventional pension benefits are inherently superior to individual retirement accounts. I am not one of these people. I believe that we can wisely plan for our own retirement and that employers can encourage adequate retirement savings. But if you believe that pensions are inherently superior, then the pension underfunding problem is even more serious since it threatens good benefits. Using better assumptions and shorter debt payment periods is more important if you think these alternative plans are inferior. So overall, what I want is a system that is current, that is no debts kicked onto future taxpayers, one that is affordable, and one that is predictable. Now, these can be accomplished with my two reform suggestions. You can use better funding assumption. This is hard, but it's important. And we can convert to other types of retirement plans that reduce or eliminate underfunding risks. And really, that's all I've got on the basics of pension underfunding and what to do about it. And thank you and welcome any questions.
Hey, James, can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Did I hear you correctly that you said we had 18 years left on a debt from the 1990s?
Well, so It's actually more than that, because we're doing present value future cash flows for all of the people who are earning pensions in this system. So part of these pension liabilities for the school retirement system are things, are for people who like retired in the 80s and are still collecting pensions. So, but in the 90s, they set this, well, what's called an amortization window, where they said, all right, we're recognizing pension debts, we're going to pay it off over a period of years. And they chose at that time 50 years. Now, we haven't stuck to that. We've changed it. The current plan is 18 years. That does pay for some debts that are really old, but also some debts that are new too, because a lot of this underfunding has happened over the past 20 years.
All right. Another question. So what happens in cities like Highland Park where there is no revenue to make pension contributions? Is this why the state of Michigan stop and or cut pensions for state employees due to underfunding? Actually, those are two questions.
Yeah.
Happens in cities like Highland Park where there's no revenue to make pension contributions.
The answer for Highland Park is I really have no idea. Highland Park is in such trouble. The courts are already involved there trying to deal with the issue that they're insolvent, which is they've got more, they have more creditors than they have revenue to pay for them. They're struggling with options. They've been, they were in emergency management for a while, and one of their emergency managers was misusing funds or something like that. So I don't have a good answer for Highland Park. It's something that the state's been struggling with, and that local leaders in Highland Park have been struggling with. For the other question, the state cannot cut pension benefits, as in, like, if you've earned a pension benefit, that's a contractual right for it. The state can't say no. What you can do is say, you know, for your future service, you're going to earn pension benefits under different formulas. They've done that, and they did another thing where they said, look, if you want to stick on this other system, you're going to have to pay some more. I don't always like those things. I think you should look at the assumptions and your payment schedules. That will have a larger fiscal impact than trying to shift responsibility for the normal cost of pre-funding benefits.
Okay. Is there any kind of requirement, like with Social Security, where the money left over has to be converted to bonds and the money goes back into the general fund?
Okay, so this pension funding is pension pre-funding is very different from Social Security, which operates on a pay-as-you-go basis, which is your Social Security contributions don't go to an account that gets invested and gets returns to pay for your benefits. It goes to pay for current retirees or current Social Security beneficiaries. It's just a completely different world, so that right now, those pension contributions go into a trust fund to pay for what employees have earned. It's a we have huge trust funds out there, tons of investments that are providing returns to the pension system. But you cannot, these are restricted trust funds. The state has not taken money out of that to pay for its current expenses. That would be unethical, probably unconstitutional. That would be something that if they tried, I would hope our employee groups, ourselves, and anyone else would cry foul over that kind of activity. Now, that's different from what they do, which is try and find ways to minimize what gets put into the system and use that money for other things. There have been some discussions about that. A lot of that's using accounting gimmicks. I think that we should be looking to increase contributions into these pension systems. It will save us tons of money over the long term, better protect pensioners, and we're just a better state if we do that. So I would hope that you guys, if you get elected, would push back on any attempts to underfund pensions.
Has anyone analyzed public sector workers who retire with pension and then go right back to a public sector job while collecting said pension? Is this still happening among senior police and fire workers?
So some of that happens. A lot of times, some of that does happen. These rules get changed probably every other year as certain needs arise, and some people say, look, we've got openings, we've got experienced people, just let them collect. It's not a big issue for pension funding, as in it won't underfund pensions if you allowed them to do that, as long as pensions are properly funded. But if they're not, and you're allowing people to collect their pension and continue working, you're kind of exacerbating some of the problems that you get with pension underfunding. And again, like, that's the key issue. If we had properly funded pensions, you could allow that type of double dipping, and it really just wouldn't matter.
Yeah, I would just add a comment that back in 2003, when I was working in Texas, we had a $10 billion budget hole in that particular legislative session. And one of the things that they did was to allow state workers to retire, spend 30 days out, and then come back to state employment while collecting both salary and their pension, the whole double dipping issue. The main thing they were trying to accomplish with that was to get the workers off of the state employee healthcare system, which had to be funded in real time, and put them onto the retiree healthcare system. And they created a bigger, they got through their short-term crunch, but created a bigger
problem. So that's kind of an interesting point that you bring up, because if you allow them to tap into their pensions and then cut their salary, you've switched their the source of their compensation from current taxpayers to the pension fund. And like, again, that's kind of, that will have no effects if pensions were properly funded, as in you've already paid for that pensions, you can allow people to tap into it. But when pensions are underfunded, that's a different story.
All right. The next two questions are kind of related, dealing with the transition from defined benefit to defined contribution. Part one, what are the costs if we wanted to convert all employees? And the second one is, if we're changing most of our retirement from defined benefit to defined contribution, when are the defined benefit programs expected to phase out?
All right, so we'll go with the most recent one. In 1997, the state employee started offering the state employee retirement system started offering new employees defined contribution plans. That's taken till now. Like, there's still a couple of people still working under the old DB system. Most people are under the newer system. So it takes, you know, this is now 23 years. It takes a while to do this one. And on top of that, the system was fully funded at that time, and then we just kept deferring payments, we used bad assumptions, and we've got those unfunded liabilities again. So even when you convert, you still have to manage the benefits that people have earned until that last beneficiary stops collecting. So that's a really important thing to consider. But converting to a defined contribution plan does contain your ability to rack up continued unfunded liabilities. Now, with regards to the cost of converting, got a paper on that. Five options to address transition costs when converting to a defined contribution plan for the state employees or the school public school employees retirement system. And the answer is, it doesn't have to cost you anything unless you want it to. And there are good reasons to want to put more money into the pension system. But the fact that you're offering new employees defined contribution benefits instead of defined benefit pensions doesn't force you to put anything more into the system unless you want to. And sometimes they want to.
Okay. Are the trust funds for the pension plans being forced to be funded with state bonds?
No, not yet. The state, like, when it gets its pension contributions and it chooses how to invest it, I think it could probably purchase state bonds with that money. I don't know that they do that. I would have to look at their total investments. But there is this idea that, look, if we need $50 billion into the pension system, let's just borrow $50 billion and put that into the pension system and pay interest costs instead of interest costs in the on pension debts. That's a solution where it's like, the solution to more debt is not more debt. It's to pay down your debts. So it gets talked about every once in a while. It might get talked about in the future. It's really just kind of doubling down on your debt problems as it begins already. So.
Okay. We have two more questions before we switch topics. If you have anything else on your mind that's not already in the chat window, please email me directly, and I will connect you with James, and the two of you can get the answer to your question via email. First one is, covering unfunded pension liabilities directly results in failure to return revenue sharing to cities. Sales taxes are not returned to communities, I guess, statutory revenue sharing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I mean, the local governments still get their 10% of constitutional revenue sharing. Sales taxes, the statutory revenue sharing part that is in statute is, we're not providing that. We haven't been providing that for a while, but it's also non-binding in the first place. It's whatever lawmakers decide to budget for statutory revenue sharing is what they give out. That money can be used to be put into pensions, unfunded pension liabilities, but for the most part, local governments pay for their pension underfunding costs with their largest revenue source, which is property taxes. So I hope that answered that question.
Okay. And let me, the other one was, how much worse is the picture if we include OPEBs in the situation? Are those also contractual obligation in the Constitution?
Mm-hmm. So there is some Supreme Court case law that says no, the retiree healthcare benefits are gratuities with the exception of those that are etched into collective bargaining agreements. And even the bindingness of the terms of those collective bargaining agreements are up in the air. But local governments are trying to skirt that issue by pre-funding retiree healthcare benefits. In fact, we're one of the few states where a lot of our governments are starting to pre-fund these benefits. And so even though they're not contractual obligations, they are being funded. We are setting aside money to pay for them, and so that those obligations have become less. In addition, like every government employees are covered by Medicare as well, and so you know the most that you're going to pay out in OPEB per employee is your annual health insurance premiums. So it's a smaller problem.
Yeah.
It's and it's something that we're trying to pre-fund.
All right. So there's one question that showed up in the window right after I closed it off. I have forwarded it to James and connected you to via email, and he will answer that after tonight's program. Thank you for all of your questions and good conversation. We will now switch gears to economic development policy in the state of Michigan. We have with us now Michael LaFave. He is the senior director of the Maury Fiscal Policy Initiative at the Mackinac Center. He has been with us for 25 years and really done a lot of seminal work in the area of economic development policy and research into the effectiveness of state incentive programs. So let me get his program queued up. And Mike, you're up.
Thank you, David. I appreciate that kind introduction and welcome, candidates. It's great to be here tonight and to have a chance to talk to you about one of my favorite areas of research and writing in the public policy world, and that is on economic development, as Dave had mentioned. As many of you know, the state runs a myriad of programs designed to increase the amount of economic growth and development that occurs in the state, often summed up by simply saying jobs, you know, increase the number of jobs and good jobs available to Michigan citizens. And they've long done so. In fact, I think the modern era really began in the 1940s with Governor Kim Sigler, and then every governor since Kim Sigler in the 1940s has tried to put their own stamp on economic development policy in Michigan, trying to create better opportunities for Michigan citizens by creating programs that create more jobs. At least that's the idea behind them. The Mackinac Center has also been around for a very long time, and so we've had a chance to weigh in time and again on the effectiveness of various programs and even recommend alternatives to them. To give you an idea about the scope of the fiscal policy put behind economic development programs, Dave, if I could have the next slide, I'd like to point out just one program that we've operated in the recent past ran from 1995 to 2011, and it was known as the Michigan Economic Growth Authority. The authority was tasked with finding corporations that they thought would be real comers, real future players in the economic development sphere, adding employment and opportunity for Michigan citizens, and then try to help them along by offering them particular tax favors and subsidies. And during the lifetime of the program, where they were still giving out these incentives, they offered up more than $14 billion to hundreds of corporations through the mega program alone. And frequently, when they would strike a mega deal with these corporations to add jobs in Michigan or retain them, they would often pile on incentives from other state programs. And early on, they even mandated that local units of government contribute an incentive to help out as well. So you can see the fiscal policy that was put behind trying to bring more jobs and better jobs to Michigan, as well as keep existing ones here. It's quite an extraordinary effort, and this is just one of the programs. This program, by the way, we may still be on the hook for over $6 billion in future payouts, provided that the corporations who struck agreements with the state live up to their stipulation in their contract with the mega, with the authority. Now, because of the possible impact on the state economy and the state budget, I'd like to spend the next 12 minutes or so going over the state's economic development apparatus, where you can find on-budget economic development line items, familiarize you with a number of programs that you should know about that still exist today or have been shuttered, and describe some of the academic and other research that has been done, not only on Michigan-specific programs, but on programs like ours that are run elsewhere and studied by scholars with no dog in Michigan's fight whatsoever. The scholarship on this is quite extraordinary, and I'm delighted to share it with you. I'd also like to give you a brief overview of why the Mackinac Center has more often than not opposed such interventionist policies in the name of creating jobs. We think there are alternatives that are more broad-based and efficient and less expensive and certainly fairer than what we've seen played out here in the state of Michigan. Dave, if I could have the next slide. There are two state institutions that are primarily responsible for the state's economic development programs in Michigan: the Michigan Strategic Fund and the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Technically, the Michigan Strategic Fund is responsible for most of the programs, but the Michigan Economic Development Corporation is their administrative arm or wingman, and they provide a great deal of the grinding research that goes into trying to pick the best companies to assist with subsidies or tax credits, abatements, and that sort of thing. They also do the public relations work behind announcing the deals and testify in the legislature, as well as produce reports for lawmakers. You'll probably even hear the words Michigan Economic Development Corporation more often than you hear the words Michigan Strategic Fund, simply because they're responsible for so much, including the public relations efforts behind many of the programs. What you won't find in the state budget is a reference to the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. When dollars are appropriated by the legislature, they're appropriated to the Michigan Strategic Fund, which appears in section 109 of the state budget. This is where the Michigan Strategic Fund words appear, and they are underneath a larger area known as the Department of Labor and Economic Opportunity. Dave, if you could advance the slide, please. In fiscal year 2020, $241 million was approved by the legislature last fall for Michigan Strategic Fund on-budget programs. What people don't often realize is that the MEDC receives tens of millions of dollars more in financial aid for its economic development programs, thanks to an agreement struck with Indian tribes in the state. And the arrangement is that the Indian gaming revenues will flow directly to the MEDC and not through the legislature. I bring this up because many sitting legislators that I've met have been surprised to learn that the MEDC gets money that they never voted for. It flows directly to them. If you're looking for information about the line items that appear under the Michigan Strategic Fund, I'd like to point you towards the House Fiscal Agency. I've captured for this particular slide a portion of the House Fiscal Agency's website. It's very easy to find online. And if you go to their website, you'll see that blue ribbon down there. And the third item over is appropriations. I recommend you click on that and look for line item summaries, because there is a treasure trove of budget information there related to the Michigan Strategic Fund and the rest of the state budget that will be very, very useful to you. For the 10 line items under the Michigan Strategic Fund budget, you can actually get a description of what the line item does and what the source revenue is. Is it federal? Is it restricted? Is it state GFGP? All of that's there and available for you to examine. Now, there are a number of programs I want to familiarize you with very briefly. Dave, if you could advance the next slide, please. The first is one I've already brought up. It's the Michigan Economic Growth Authority, and I bring this up because it bears repeating. It was really the biggest program in Michigan history, I think, by size and the number of deals, perhaps even. Well, not the number of deals, but certainly the size of them and what was dedicated in terms of the amount of subsidies offered, plus the arrangement for other subsidies from different programs. I've already mentioned that some $14 billion was approved. What I did not say is that it was such an influential and obvious program that there have been 5 academic-style studies done specifically about the Michigan Economic Growth Authority. The Mackinac Center did 2 of these. Of the 5, 4 of them found a 0 to -negative impact from the program. That is, despite dedicating billions of dollars to this program, the impacts ranged from 0 to -negative in 4 out of 5 studies. The 5th study, which was done by the Upjohn Institute and was a very high quality study as well, did find a more positive impact. There was a 6th academic study which did not focus on mega specifically, but did focus on how states in the Midwest used their economic development policies to come out of the Great Recession. And they actually concluded the study by describing mega as a debacle of a program, which I thought was quite powerful. The Snyder administration wanted to replace the Michigan Economic Growth Authority with a smaller program that was actually on budget. You can't find a line item for MEGA in the state budget. You never could. But so Governor Snyder wanted to replace it with something that he could engage in the appropriations discussion with, so he would know what they needed to plan for in the coming year in terms of dollars taken from the Treasury. So they developed the Michigan Business Development Program, which is a grant and loan program to hand out subsidies to corporations that promise to create X number of jobs because of some particular project. We did a study of our own on the MBDP, and we actually found a net negative result. We found that for every $500,000 actually paid out for projects, there was a corresponding loss of some 600 jobs in the county in which the project was located. It wasn't at the company itself. It was in the county overall. There was a link between the MBDP and those job losses. The Upjohn Institute, once again, took a look at the MBDP. After we took a look at it, they found a more positive result as well. They used a similar technique as they did with the MEGA program. And since then, the Mackinac Center's looked at this again, using a different data set and measuring technique, and we once again found a negative result. So the debate continues, but we think we're on solid ground here, suggesting that this program is not as effective as other options. The 21st Century Jobs Fund was a creation of during the Granholm years in 2005. She had bipartisan support. This was not simply something that she wanted. And it was designed to fund a myriad of other programs, from high-tech investments to very risky seed capital programs, kind of like venture capital, investing in venture capital fund of funds. Centers of Energy Excellence, there was an energy component to it as well. There have been 2 reviews of this program. My colleague, James Holman, has done one, and the Free Press did a terrific one years ago. And on balance, they found that the programs were really not as advertised and had shortcomings despite dedicating hundreds of millions of dollars to the program and producing few jobs that, even by a simple accounting standard, using data that was reported from the companies who had received the subsidies. There was one study done that found a positive result, but that was funded by the industry that was benefiting from the program, or one of them. And that study actually tossed out something like 400 companies from the analysis that had received a subsidy but disappeared, either went bankrupt or left the state. So they started with just the global collection of study or companies that were still in business for the state of Michigan. The Pure Michigan program, you're probably familiar with. It has gotten famous around the country for its beautiful advertisements with voiceovers from Tim Allen. The 21st, the Pure Michigan program was designed, at least in part, to help lure tourists to Michigan and hope that they would spend their money here and generate economic development and growth. The state was claiming very high returns on investment early on in the program's life, and we kept asking them to provide the consultants methodology. How are you coming up with these high returns on investment? And they refused to provide it to us because the consultant refused to explain to the MEDC how they got their numbers. So we went out and gathered 40 years of data, and we did our own study, and we found a net negative for the program as well. We found that for every $1 million increase in tourism promotion spending, there was a corresponding increase, a positive increase of $20,000 in extra economic activity in the hotel and motel industry of any state that really increases their tourism promotion by $1 million. Michigan did not deviate from the average. So it was ultimately a huge net negative. The program remained quite popular, in part due to the beautiful ads, but the program dollars were recently vetoed by Governor Whitmer when she was trying to reprioritize state spending to redirect money to our efforts in putting down the COVID-19 pandemic and addressing those issues here in the state. Lastly, good jobs for Michigan. This was a program that existed very briefly for a couple of years. It had $200 million authorized for its awarding or luring corporations into Michigan. It has sunset. Last year it sunset. There may be an attempt to bring it back in the new legislature, but I wanted to bring that to your attention in case it is. Early research suggests that these types of programs are ineffective, specifically the type that Good Jobs for Michigan was, where the company was actually allowed to keep a percentage of their employees' income taxes that would normally go to the state treasury. And Dave, if you could forward the slide for me, I would like to just pause for a moment and mention that over time I've met many legislators who have sort of come around on the economic development programs. You know, when Michigan's film incentive was passed, there was only one no vote in the entire legislature. But when the Good Jobs for Michigan was ultimately passed in 2017, the vote total was much closer. People had to fight to get this passed. And then when the sunset provision came up, they couldn't get enough votes to extend the life of the program at that time. So people have changed their opinions on these economic development issues, including some high-profile ones like Jim Ananick, the Senate Minority Leader. Dave and I had a nice conversation with him where he said, you know, when I first came to office, I appreciated these programs. It was the aughts and we were suffering a one-state recession, and these programs looked like good ideas for keeping jobs we already had or creating new ones. And he said he came around. He said, over time, I just don't think that these are the most effective routes on balance. Some other program or opportunity may come up where it is, but he seems to be one of the major players that came around on this issue. The Mackinac Center has found that these programs are basically ineffective, expensive, and unfair. That's how we view most of the economic development programs run by the state. The research that we've done and mostly that other people have done have found zero to negative impacts. There's one outside study I want to cite to support that assertion. It comes out of Iowa, where two economists actually swept up into their orbit 300 other studies about other economic development programs. And they read all of them, summarized them, categorized the results, and wrote them up in an academic peer-reviewed paper. And they called the study The Failures of Economic Development Incentives. And there was a key paragraph I want to read to you from that study. They write, many public officials appear to believe that they can influence the course of their state and local economies through incentives and subsidies to a degree far beyond anything supported by even the most optimistic evidence. So these programs are ineffective on balance. They're also very expensive, not only in direct terms, but in opportunity cost terms. The mega program in 2016 actually paid out $1 billion worth of subsidies to a handful of corporations, which was almost precisely the amount of money brought in by the state's corporate income tax. So at least in that year, they could have lived without a corporate income tax, but nobody offered to do that. A few lucky manufacturers got incentives where everybody else had to pay full freight. The film incentive program, we paid out $500 million in subsidies before pulling the plug on that. There were actually fewer film incentive jobs at the end of 5 years than there was at the beginning of the program. There's also the opportunity costs involved here. The money being dedicated to these programs could be used for higher priorities, including ones that have their own economic development consequences. I'm thinking of roads and bridges. Building good road and infrastructure is an efficient use of the dollars typically and show a positive return on investment. They're their own economic development program in many ways. And last year, we suggested eliminating the state's corporate welfare or economic development apparatus in favor of spending that money on roads and bridges. You could also use it for tax cuts. There are personal income tax cuts that may have never be made because of all the money we've dedicated to our corporate welfare efforts. And of course, the programs are unfair in our view. They rob a lot of Peters to pay a few corporate Pauls and not necessarily with great economic development consequences. Great example is out of Flint. Kohler Meats has been there 100 years, family-owned business for many generations, never taken a dime of government money for subsidies and at the federal or state level, and yet they wake up one day and hear the MEDC bragging about this company that they've lured to Michigan and ultimately with the tax dollars of their competitor, luring their competitor here to Michigan with their tax dollars. So in summary, I'd like to say that we find that the evidence indicates that these programs are ineffective. The money would be better spent elsewhere and in a fairer way. So with that, I'll take any questions that you might have, including one I just saw pop up on the chat window here.
Is that the report that you're referencing?
Well, I'd have to take a look at the report. Let's see.
The Failures of Economic Development.
Yes, that's it. By the Iowa economists.
Peters and Fisher.
Yeah. Peters and Fisher. They're terrific scholars. We've talked a number of times about economic development. We don't always agree on other fiscal policy topics, but on economic development subjects, we do. He was interviewed, one of the authors was interviewed in the Detroit News, and the Detroit News said to him, well, we can't unilaterally disarm because other people will steal our jobs. And their response was, of course you can disarm. These programs aren't effective anyway.
Yeah, it's a great presentation, great background. One additional piece I would make all of you aware of is that there has been a bill package in the legislature that was introduced end of last year or earlier this year, where you had probably about one third of the Michigan Senate and about 20 to 30 members of the Michigan House, roughly an even split between Republicans and Democrats, sign on to a five-bill package dealing with accountability and transparency of our state's economic development programs. One of which would be to make sure that, or to restore the ability to see what companies are getting from the mega program right now, and I believe since 2009, that information has been by law held confidential within the Department of Treasury. There's another bill right now where companies and the economic development agencies are allowed to keep the details of their agreements a secret before they vote on the deal, sort of like the whole have to pass it to know what's in it. What we have proposed is that the public has to have access to at least the term sheets before the agents, for a period of time before the agencies can vote. There are three other bills in the package. Another of them, if a company that has an existing economic development agreement needs to amend the contract to reduce the number of jobs that they're expected to create, that the amount of the incentive they're eligible for has to go down by a proportionate amount. And I'm trying to remember right offhand what the other two are.
Proportional reduction?
Yeah, we got that.
Revert to general fund.
Oh, revert to general fund, where right now you have the when a company fails to meet the terms of its agreement and is clawed back within the MEDC, the money goes back to the MEDC rather than into the general fund. We believe it would be better to have that money sent back into the appropriations process so that, number one, appropriators can be aware of the number of agreements that fall through, and number two, have the opportunity to revisit whether that is the best and highest use of those dollars rather than perhaps redirecting them to other priorities. So yeah, there's those bills have been heard on the House side. We're waiting for the committee to return to normal business and send those through the process. Have some questions. First question, can you explain again how Michigan Good Jobs is funded with income taxes withheld? Is that right?
Basically, it goes through the state. It's the corporations are not allowed to directly keep the income taxes that would normally flow to the Treasury, but there was within the Treasury a unit not an agency, but an area of the state budget where the taxes would be paid, but the state would give back the money equal to the amount of personal income tax paid by their employees.
Yeah. So basically, it's a legalized kickback. Don't set up a structure like that between you and your employees. I've seen legislators do that before they wind up in prison.
One more item, Dave, real quick. There's a program just like that out of Kansas. It's been studied by a terrific scholar, and they found that companies in Kansas that had gone into this program and received the incentive were no more likely to create jobs on net term and net balance over time than those who had not, those like companies, very similar companies that had not received the incentive.
What do you think of groups like the Southwest Michigan First and Economic Incubators? Does the state have any place in those aside from providing good infrastructure, education, and low taxes?
Do they have a place within those groups? I understand that some of these groups, they advocate very much for economic growth and development in their area, but that particular group and another on the west side, they're very, very tied into the state economic development apparatus and are defenders of the status quo, whether it was MEGA during that era or local property tax abatements. They have a great interest in ensuring that these programs continue so that they can do their jobs trying to lure companies to Michigan by hanging these in front of them.
Would your solution for economic development be to lower corporate income taxes?
Well, at the time, we thought there was a good link. I mean, there is a link between that because the past program with MEGA was a refundable tax credit against the then corporate income tax, whether it was the SBT or the MBT. And so we thought that there was a natural tie there. You might get bigger economic bang for your buck by using the savings from ending these programs elsewhere, such as a cut to the personal income tax, or even with road funding.
But I would just add that really, if you're looking at the companies that are seeking these incentives, they typically fall into two categories. Number one, that are looking for, they're looking for short-term cash to pad their bottom line, or number two, that they generally like a state from a location perspective, but that there are specific aspects of the business climate that are not competitive with other states and other opportunities that you're looking at. If you have a situation where you're finding that companies are not interested in locating in your state because of a bad policy area, whether it's the road infrastructure, whether it's workforce development, whether it's regulatory structure or land use restrictions or workers' comp. Those are the things that companies will be looking for you to pay them to compensate for. I think what we would say generally is address those big picture issues and put resources toward what you need to become competitive in those areas. When I was in Texas, one of the big things, and by way of background, I lived in Texas and worked down there until about 2 years ago when the Mackinac Center brought me up. And one of the big things around the turn of the century was the civil justice system was very, very tilted toward plaintiff's attorneys and these big, huge judgments from people who had no nexus to Texas, but they would find a friendly venue and get this ridiculous judicial verdict and massive jury. And so you'd have a lot of businesses that would try to limit their exposure there. The legislature in 2003 recognized that. They passed a pretty comprehensive legal reform package, and Texas jumped up the ratings and became a lot more attractive place for businesses to locate. So
broad-based changes to public policy of what we call the fair field and no favors approach to economic development.
Yeah. And why we keep coming back to road funding is that something where you can put the resources and it affects the quality of life and the quality of the business climate for all businesses and the quality of life for all Michiganders. So, you know, those sorts of things, you really get a lot of traction. Do you have any suggestions of ways that government can help to coordinate economic development rather than attempt to fund it?
Well, they can maintain a portion of their apparatus now for doing that. One of the problems, however, is bureaucracies tend to grow over time, and with a bureaucracy still in place, it's easy to reinstate programs. I would say that there is an option for that, and it's chambers of commerce. They want to facilitate economic development, and they can serve as, you know, a sort of a clearinghouse for information for their area or for the whole state, as we have a state chamber. So I think there's a terrific private sector solution or parallel with state chambers.
Yeah, and you can also find that with the industry associations as well. Mm-hmm. Have you looked at community capital as an alternative means of local economic development? For example, support of the creation of intrastate trading markets for small business debt and equity offerings?
Yeah, that might be the only program idea we haven't looked at. We've certainly looked at the capital being used and the state loaning its great credit rating to entrepreneurs, but we haven't looked at these types of community capital alternatives.
All right. Well, that's the last question. It is exactly 9:30, so we'll wrap up tonight's program. Thank you to everyone for being here. I think tonight may be our high water mark as far as attendance. So we will be back here Thursday night, get into K-12 education and criminal justice. So thanks, everyone. Good luck on the campaign trail, and we'll see you Thursday.